Good afternoon, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. Rob Zavalia, registration number 34974 for the City of Colorado Springs. In order to properly analyze the error in the district court's holding that the City of Colorado Springs affirmatively waived governmental immunity in the underlying action, it's important to have a relatively precise view of the timeline of events that were reduced at the Trinity hearing. In the late 1800s, private enterprise developed a coal gasification facility on the property that's now known as 25 Chimino Drive in Colorado Springs. The product of that facility was used to power street lamps in the city, and that production of coal gas continued until 1925, when the City of Colorado Springs itself purchased the facility. The city maintained operation of the coal gasification plant through 1931, at which point technological developments in the processing and distribution of natural gas made coal gasification obsolete. The city ceased to use the property for coal gasification at that point, and the plant itself went idle. Between 1931 and the mid-1950s, the uncontroverted facts show that the property in its state during coal gasification was gradually dismantled to a point where the last man-made structures at the facility were removed in the mid-1950s. Those last man-made structures were subterranean tanks that were used to store coal tar, which is a byproduct of the coal gasification production. The only evidence adduced at the Trinity hearing concerning the removal of those tanks was on-site inspections that were part of the public record. Those inspections indicated that to the engineers who were doing the removal, the tanks themselves were not in a defective condition and showed no evidence of leakage. So between 1950 and later use of the property in the mid-1960s, we essentially have what is reverted to as a natural state property. There are no man-made attachments, no man-made structures. It is not being used for any purpose. In the mid-1960s, the city decided to purpose that property for the creation of an office building. Now, the office building, as has been discussed in the briefs and in the case below, was in fact for Colorado Springs Utilities Division. And in the utilities division, gas operations, administrative gas operations, were performed. The building itself was built in the 1960s and began operation as an administrative facility, no different than any other facility, any other building tasked with office work for government use. That takes us up to 1971. In 1971, the Colorado Supreme Court issued a trilogy of cases led by Evans, abrogating what had existed up to that point, which was unqualified sovereign immunity for state actors. That means that for the entirety of time that coal gasification was conducted on the property in question, the city of Colorado Springs enjoyed complete sovereign immunity for the acts occasioned during the production. In 1971, when the Evans case and the trio of Evans cases were issued, the Colorado Supreme Court invited the Colorado legislature to revisit the issue of sovereign immunity by saying that if you think this is a compelling state interest, go ahead and pass legislation to reenact it. The legislature did just that in the following session. In 1972, we have the enactment of the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, 2410-101, et sec. That immunity act reestablished sovereign immunity as law in Colorado with some limited exceptions. And now from that point going forward, we observe the acts of the city on the property through the locus of the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act and the specific waivers to it. I point these out to illustrate that our contention of error in the trial court's ruling below was because it did two things. Number one, it took statutory exceptions that exist in the 71, 72 and later Governmental Immunity Act and imported them into historical activity that occurred at the latest the 1930s or the 1950s, essentially importing a statutory structure of liability back in time. Now, we have what you could consider a novel issue of facts and law intersecting here, because there is not a lot of reported cases that deal with a situation of facts like this, but we're not laid bare with our inability to look at the facts and analyze what the law should be in this instance. Under canons of statutory construction and interpretation, we know that Colorado does not, as a matter of course, view the application of statutory law retroactively unless the statute itself says so. And if you look at the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, it does not state that it applies retroactively to claims that caused or accrued prior to its enactment in 1972. We also know that as a matter of going forward construction, we do have cases that help us interpret what happens in the two instances that the court used at the trial level to analyze and find a waiver. Well, those two instances fall into two categories. Number one is the dangerous condition of a public building, or number two, the operation and maintenance of a gas facility. Cases like Jalot show us that, at least as far as the second application is concerned, operation is a gas facility, that the statute is construed to analyze operations of an otherwise immune entity from the perspective of, are they producing and distributing natural gas, some type of gas product. It is not, is the facility in question, does it have gas in its title? To do so would invite saying that every public building in the state is involved in the process, the manufacture or sale of gas. And that can't be an interpretation that makes sense of the Governmental Immunity Act.
Well, as I read the court's order, the conclusion was that the building was related to the operation of the gas company.
I think that's what the court did say, and I think that's part of the error, Your Honor, because Jalot tells us, let's use Jalot for an example. So in that case, the Colorado Department of Transportation has fuel storage tanks on the facility, not involved in the production or distribution of gas. It's CDOT, it gases up its trucks on that site. Now, because of the existence of gas and the ability to fuel up a car on the site, the question was raised, well, does this go to the level of the operation and maintenance of a gas facility exception to the Governmental Immunity Act? And the court's decision there was no. The incidental use of tanks and fueling for the operation of CDOT on the property does not rise to the level of what the legislature intended, was that the operation and maintenance of a gas facility language in the GIA apply to a facility that creates, distributes, and pumps out natural gas. So that's not the case we have here. The closest you'll ever get in from the post-1971 existence of the property in question, closest you'll ever get to gas is the name of the gas entity, the Colorado Gas Utility that was on the building. But they did no more production or distribution of gas on that facility than this court does in using natural gas to heat the interior. The second aspect of the trial court's determination of waiver had to do with the maintenance of a public building. So you look at our split time in two ways here. Going backwards and taking that exception into the past, we look at the factors that the court must consider in determining whether that waiver happened by what did the property look like at the time the GIA was passed. At that point, any remnant of an actual gas production facility did not exist. At the latest, it was 50 years prior. At the earliest, it was about 25 years prior. There was no attachment, appurtenance, product, nothing concerning a public facility that existed at the time of the Governmental Immunity Act's passage that rise to the level of gas production or any type of production, and nothing that rose to the level of being a public building for which the plaintiff's claim of injury. And part of this requires us looking at the causal nexus of what the plaintiff's claim for injury is. It's not that they walked in on the property and tripped over something, which would be the dangerous condition of a public building. It's that they're somehow harmed by a plume of subterranean volatile hydrocarbons that they have in some manner or another come into contact here. Well, that is not contact with an actual public facility. It's not, in all the cases we look at that discuss this, the fixtures cases, you know, you have an elementary school where a kid runs into a wall. You have a college where somebody cuts part of their hand off using a woodworking implement. You have, I call it the cow versus motorcycle case, where you have somebody that actually runs into a cow that got onto a roadway through a fence that had not been maintained. The mechanism of injury in all these cases is an actual interaction with the property in question, and that has not happened in this case.
Mr. Zavalia, what do you say to this notion that maintenance of a public building would necessarily include its destruction?
I think that if the legislature had intended that to be read that broadly, it would have said so, because the words were certainly available to it at the time. And because it's interesting you ask that, you know, if you look at the historical timeline of what happened prior to the GIA's passage and what happened afterwards, if the legislature had intended retroactive intent, it would have said that, and we would have seen a flurry of cases at that point. Well, maybe not in a less litigious society in the 70s, but we would have seen a flurry of cases looking back to the entire history of Colorado, back to its territorial status, and people looking for ways to pierce sovereign immunity since it no longer existed. But that doesn't mean that the legislature wasn't careful with it, with its language when it enacted it going forward. And we have this issue, so you look at statutory interpretation. We understand that the cases interpreting the GIA say two things, that the waivers should be read narrowly and construed broadly. Well, what does that mean? That's essentially a grant by the legislature and by the Colorado Supreme Court saying, trial courts, if the facts line up to what the legislature has clearly laid out, then please don't hold back in saying there's a waiver. But you have to make sure that the facts you're analyzing fall specifically within the GIA before the waiver applies. And because of that, I think that gives us a pretty clear insight into your question of, well, what about other obligations? What about destruction? Well, fine, destruction's not in the language of the statute, so that's the first answer to that question. The second answer is that there was no evidence in the Trinity hearing, and even under any circumstance, if we had to do this again, all the evidence involving the construction on the property going back to coal gasification days was included in the record. There's no evidence that destruction of the administrative building had anything to do with subterranean migration of pollutants. Now, another aspect of your question might go to the asbestos thing. This is the surface pollution, which is also a part of the case, and I may address that in rebuttal. I will hold on very quickly. In the record, it was clear from the testimony that the last buildings that had friable asbestos, which could have been the airborne pollutant, were destroyed through a process of licensed remediation no later than the end of 2012. And the dust storm giving rise to plaintiff's claim of being exposed to pollutants happened in March of 2013. So there's a temporal disconnect in that as well. I will reserve the balance of my time.
You have about 3 minutes and 15 seconds, Mr. Zaria.
Good afternoon. My name is Randall Weiner, number 23871.
Mr. Weiner, I don't mean to interrupt you right off the bat before you get a chance to start your presentation, but I'm curious about what happens when my stockbroker sells me Schlumberger. Is his office related to the operation of an oil and gas facility?
When your stockbroker sells you
Schlumberger, publicly traded oil and gas company. It's trading at about $95.
Okay.
Now. and so I'm interested because that seems to me to be no more attenuated from the operation of an oil and gas company than an administrative building that sends out bills is related to the operation of a gas plant.
To call the building an administration building is to denigrate its role. It had 120 employees, 50 of whom went into the field. It was the utility headquarters for the natural gas utility for many years. More importantly, there's no dispute that from 1925 to 1931, this facility operated as a coal gasification plant when the contaminants were made.
Well, that's my second point, is that once you get rid of any kind of connection between the operation of this headquarters building and an oil and gas plant, then you have to make the GIA retroactive. How do you do that?
You do it by looking at the definition of maintenance, and that's where opposing counsel's argument falls through. The definition of maintenance, and we're talking about the exception which applies to the maintenance and operation of a gas facility, refers specifically to not allowing a facility to fall into a state of disrepair. And I would submit that in many environmental contamination cases, you have the same situation, Judge Graham, and that is contamination begins and the impacts happen years later and the connection is attenuated. But not, we don't have that attenuation here. They've owned the facility from the time that they produced the contaminants. They knew, it's the city of Colorado Springs, that they needed to maintain the facility. Otherwise, it's pure negligence. And in fact, they didn't maintain the facility. Even in the 2000s, when they were beginning to do this VCOP, this voluntary cleanup program, when they knew about the contamination, they knew it had migrated onto my client's property. They were in the midst of developing a hotel. They went to the state and commenced a voluntary cleanup program, then gave up the voluntary cleanup when the hotel developer no longer was putting money into the project. That's a situation that invites the kind of bad policy that Judge Schutz referred to, which is, if you take the argument that if you don't operate a facility in the precise exact same manner for many decades, then you are off the hook for cleaning up contamination. That invites cities and municipalities to abandon their contaminated projects, their
Mr.
contaminated
Weiner,
property.
That well may be true that it invites that policy, but as I read the Powell case, there has to be a clear legislative intent that the GIA and its exceptions apply retroactively. It sounds to me like you want us to imply that intent from the word maintenance or the definition of maintenance. Is there anything else in the GIA that you think reflects a clear express intent to be applied retroactively?
You know, I don't consider this a retroactive application. I consider this more like the Springer case, the case where the woman, disabled patron at the Buell Theater here in Denver, ran into a threshold plate, and her claims accrued 20 years after that threshold plate was installed at the Buell Theater. What the Springer court was saying was that where a municipality is in a position to know of a danger and to correct the danger, that's when the GIA waivers apply. So if we step back for a second and look at the Springer case, the Supreme Court case, and interpret what's the purpose of these waivers? These waivers are to encourage good public policy in many respects. So the claims here accrued when my clients, in fact, at the very time that they filed suit, we moved for a restraining order because the demolition wasn't going as expected. That's when the claims accrued. That's when we look at the GIA and say, do the waivers apply? We don't, you know, so I would say this is not a retroactive application. The judge Judge Schutz also referred to the fact that the defendants failed to raise the issue of whether they had vested rights. And you don't have a improper retroactive application unless there's an impairment of a vested right. I submit, as the lower court suggested, that the city of Colorado Springs waived that argument by never bringing up at the Trinity hearing, the full day Trinity hearing, that they had some type of vested rights. Justice Schutz refers in his decision to a case which suggests that the city of Colorado Springs would still have been on the hook still have been on the hook for negligence even before the GIA was enacted. And I refer you to paragraph 40 of his decision in the case below.
Well, isn't
and
there
that,
requ-
was the, that was the Powell case. And he cites it as saying, long prior to the adoption of the GIA, the Supreme Court had determined that municipalities were liable for the injuries resulting from the negligent construction or maintenance of their drainage facilities. So if they were still on the hook back then, the GIA didn't take away a vested right, there's no improper retroactive application. I'm sorry, Judge.
Oh, and I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
Mr. Weiner, this concept of vested rights, isn't that placing the burden on the wrong party?
You know, Judge Schutz could not have jumped through more hoops to make sure that the exemptions were appropriate. He held a full day hearing. We didn't even have time for closing arguments. We had to submit them in writing.
I understand that, but I mean, it's your burden to show the exemption. It's not the city's burden.
It's our burden, but once we show that our case falls within the four corners of an exemption, and this is not like the other City of Colorado Springs case that you authored, where a woman, you know, parked far away from a golf course facility and trips on a parking lot, and the legislature had expressly taken parking lots away from the GIA. We fall directly in two separate provisions of the exemptions, both the dangerous condition of a public building and the maintenance and operation of a gas facility. Once a plaintiff shows that we fall within those provisions, it's the defendant's responsibility to say, wait a second, this is an improper application, or this defense applies. They, at that point, the burden at that point had shifted to the defendant. We can't read the defendant's mind. They need to raise these issues during the Trinity hearing.
Mr. Wynn, I want to ask you a little bit about the gas facility exception, because as I read the transcript, there was no testimony or evidence introduced that it was involved in the production or distribution of gas in the late 2012-2013 period. But that seemed to be the trial court's finding, that this exception applied because it was involved in the production and distribution of gas. What evidence supports that?
The court utilized the notion that it was a gas facility, and that that the activities of the facility related to the distribution of gas. That's my reading of why the activities of gas production applied into the 90s. But this is if I may segue into the whole notion of asbestos. Now we are in the 90s. Now we're dealing with a current contamination issue. The allegation of my clients in the court below were that asbestos was blowing onto our property, diminishing the value and causing health impacts. Though that asbestos activity certainly occurred in the 1990s and 2000s, and at the time that this case was filed. So there's no concern about retroactive application of the GIA with respect to the airborne asbestos contamination. In addition to the notion of bad public policy, by letting a municipality off the hook for maintaining their premises merely because they change their operations, in addition to that being very bad public policy, which actually encourages a municipality to abandon its facilities, I want to point out that, again, the Springer case and the Quintana case, which suggest that a public entity may proximately cause a condition not only by creating it, but by failing to reasonably discover and correct the unsafe condition. And again, I find it informative that in the midst of the cleanup process, that VCUP process, the City of Colorado Springs turned its back on cleanup and stopped cleaning up the premises. That certainly showed that it knew of the contamination, it was in a position to remediate it, and it failed to do so, in abrogation of the Quintana and the Springer cases' admonitions. With respect to the gas plant waiver, I don't believe, contrary to what counsel said, that the buildings themselves were all completely demolished until the 50s. My reading of the record and sitting through the hearing was that there were a number of buildings on site, including the warehouse building, into the period after the enactment of the GIA. Now, the warehouse building itself, he makes it sound like it was a brand new building that didn't contain gas operations and facilities. That warehouse building contained some of the coal tar facilities that produced these contaminants of concern. And I direct your attention to the record, specifically the record transcripts, pages 67 and 68, and exhibit page 28. The warehouse building itself was, I believe the record shows, integrally involved in the operations of the coal production. Even if it wasn't, there were other buildings on site that weren't demolished until after the GIA was established. If I'm wrong, I'm sure council will direct you to the site in the record where that's true.
You said exhibit page 28. Which exhibit?
The way I have the record is it's divided into a transcript section and an exhibit section.
Okay, so pages 66, 67 and 68 of the record.
67 and 68 of transcripts, that's where our medical doctor, public health expert, talked about the history of the buildings. And then exhibits page 28 is this old diagram of the facility.
When you use the term warehouse building, is that also been referred to as the gas admin building, or are those separate?
I use those synonymously.
Okay.
In conclusion, it is difficult to find a case that doesn't fit more squarely into the exemptions set forth in the GIA. I mentioned that this case wasn't like the prior City of Colorado Springs case. It's not like the case that Judge Dunn concurred in, where the child was bullied by older kids in the back of the bus, the Ignatia case, because there the negligent supervision did not apply to operation of a bus. Here we have a dangerous condition of a public building. A building is defined broadly for purposes of the GIA. Even if there's a question as to whether we're using the term building or facility, we use a fixtures analysis. The judge did the fixtures analysis set forth in the Reynolds case and the Gilo case, and that determination is subject to an abuse of discretion standard. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Weiner. Mr. Zavala, you have 3 minutes and 15 seconds, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, the synonymous use of the warehouse building and the gas administration building can't be squared. The gas administration building was built in the 1960s, long after and it was built from the ground up, long after coal gasification projects ended. The two outbuildings that council may have been referring to were a car wash and a mobile administrative facility, additional offices, on-site offices like you might see, and a public school. The record, especially, I think the easiest way to look at it is the 1993 first environmental report subsequent to the CERCLA identification of the property, where the historical teardown is chronicled, including the destruction and removal of those tanks, the storage tanks for the byproducts, in the 1950s. A couple of things. Mugging the waters is this equation of the term facility with the existence of a property. A facility is used in the GIA, imparts a structure, something, some man-made improvement, something that is involved in something you can walk into, something that puts something out. There's a stark difference between the existence of some activity on a property that ceased to happen in the 1930s and the continued existence of that property for repurposed use beginning in the 1960s, and indeed a use that had no causal connection to at least the gas administration, or the gas exception to the Governmental Immunity Act in 1971. The statute just doesn't contemplate that we look at a long-term historical view of the property's use and then use that to import liability into the modern era. Secondly, with the maintenance of a public facility, the dangerous condition of a public facility and maintenance thereon, that went to the asbestos question. The evidence was that at the time asbestos was identified, friable asbestos was identified on the property, it was assessed by an environmental company. A third-party contractor called Hudspeth was called in to do a remediation proposal. It did that. It sought and obtained licensure from the state of Colorado for the purpose of remediation, and then implemented that plan. At that point, we lose the issue that council is arguing, which is that the City of Colorado Springs may have even waived governmental immunity for remediation because they failed to remediate. That's not the case. They certainly did with asbestos, and that's the only evidence that was present in the Trinity hearing. Finally, we, on the talk of the Springer case, counsel said that this case is really like Springer. In their brief, they cited page 1195 in Springer, which is actually the heading for the case. And it doesn't state the proposition that a state actor has an obligation to identify and then remediate known defects. It doesn't state that at all. But if we look at Springer, Springer is instructive in how it doesn't apply to this case. Springer involved a plaintiff who was injured in a public building on public property by the thing that she tripped over. Anyway, so I'm going to close with saying that I think the court's findings below were in error. It's an issue of law, so this court should reverse the trial court's decision, find that immunity did hold for Colorado Springs, and dismiss the action. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zavalia. Thank you again, Mr. Weiner. Thanks to both counsel for excellent arguments today. I think they were helpful to the court. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That